This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Of course, the political season is upon us. Things are heating up. A big midterm election coming our way in November. And you might think, well, North Dakota, you know, North Dakota is absolutely in the bullseye this year. And it has been in the bullseye before, too. We're going to talk about a very interesting piece of North Dakota's political past with Kim Stengem. She is the producer of a brand new 3-hour-long documentary produced by Prairie Public Television titled The Rise and Fall of the Nonpartisan League. Thanks for joining us, Kim.
Well, thanks for having me, Doug.
Why did you want to tell this story?
Well, it is so unique to this state in many ways, but the first impulse really came when I was first married to my husband 45 years ago. His family is very political. They've been running for office.
Stengem,
yes. One of my brothers-in-law is currently an excellent attorney general. But I had heard that my husband's grandmother had been Bill Langer's last campaign manager.
Wow, everybody's related.
So, yeah, it's a very small town, North Dakota, with very long streets. So I had always been interested in that. My father-in-law had been the student loan officer at the Bank of North Dakota. So the history, the idea that there's a bank that's owned by the state was very strange.
Singular. It's the only state with such a thing.
It's the only one. Yep. There had been a couple others in the past, but they were very short-lived. And the Bank of North Dakota is the only one that has survived into current times. So it was such a weird idea for someone raised outside of North Dakota to kind of get their mind around. So I've been kind of studying up on it. And when the opportunity came, it was going to be my last project before I retired. What would I want to do? And that was it.
Okay, but it took a while, right?
Last
project before you got retired.
Yeah, it was a project that we had to work on for a while because the money came in little dips and dabs, and so we were very frugal and gathered while we could with as little outlay as possible. But
so that was one challenge to getting it done.
Yes, of doing an extensive history of this nature without very much of a budget really, really restricted what we could do. But the historians who specialize in this area are so excited to have the story told. Instead of me having to go out to Michigan, he came here on his own dime and did an interview. So we're very grateful for all the assistance of the people involved.
Well, a brief history lesson here. What period in the state's history are we talking about?
The story in the documentary starts in 1914. That was really the heyday of the nonpartisan league in the state. It was 1914 to 1920. And then it continued after that. You'll have to watch the documentary to know why they fell out of favor for a while. But then again in the 30s with Bill Langer revitalizing the league during the very difficult time of the agricultural depression, it came back into roaring into power and is still with us as a part of the Democratic Party.
Well, we have a Democratic Party. We have a Republican Party. We've got this thing called the Nonpartisan League. So
yes.
Obviously there was some tension there with the party structure as it existed. So how did it come to be?
Well, really the Nonpartisan League was the very natural outcome of a history in North Dakota of farmers being held down economically and politically and socially by the powers that be with all the money from the Twin Cities. The railroads made sure that the farmers paid the highest possible railroad freight to move their grain. The grain brokers made sure that the farmers got the lowest price possible while selling it for the highest price possible, and they made all the profit. They ran the political system for years and years through their political boss, Alexander Mackenzie. And in 1914, the farmers had finally managed to get through a law that would have given them their own grain elevator. And these Minneapolis and St. Paul power brokers got it killed.
Another singular project, the North Dakota Grain and Elevator, which subsequently was built.
It was, yeah. And the farmers absolutely had enough, so they decided now's the time not to create a third party, because that's very, very difficult in this country. We're really loyal to our parties. They created this league, which was outside the party structure. The league would endorse candidates who support the issues that farmers cared about, whether they were Republicans or Democrats.
So an organized group of independents?
Yes, yes, of independents. And the other thing that made it possible was that North Dakota had just recently implemented an open primary. So the league could create their own candidates and get them into the primary for inclusion on the ballot. And that came all to a head in their very first year with a stunning victory of electing all but one state official, three-fourths of the Senate, and almost three-fourths of the legislature. So they were suddenly in power and able to finally break free from Minnesota's political control.
But they must have been getting a lot of attention. Did this spread to any other states?
It did. Altogether, there were 13 other states. This largely grabbed hold in the western part. From Texas all the way up into Saskatchewan, there were 13 states that created their own state nonpartisan leagues that had varying levels of success. The thing for me that was the biggest irony is the Minnesota ended up with their own not a partisan league that evolved into the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which is now, of course, the predominant party in Minnesota politics.
Well, there was a major player, A.C. Townley, who lived in Minnesota, didn't he?
Yes, he was born. He was born in Browns Valley, Minnesota, and had been one of those, you know, curious Midwesterners that is always looking for the next big thing. He had been for a short while, a teacher, thought that the way to go was to make his fortune in wheat. And so he and his brothers set up a big wheat farm, which failed. And then he went out to Colorado and tried dryland farming and failed and came to North Dakota to become, he was called the Flax King. He and his brother had a farm that had hundreds and hundreds of acres planted in flax. And unfortunately, there was an early freeze. He lost the crop. He lost everything. And so he was kind of at loose ends and went to see the North Dakota legislative session where this elevator bill was killed. And this was his time to grab hold of finally an idea that really took him somewhere. And he got together a core group and founded the Nonpartisan League.
Ken Stengem is the producer of the brand new Prairie Public documentary, The Rise and Fall of the Nonpartisan League. It's a 3-hour documentary. It will air Monday, September 10th from 7 to 10 Central Time. But you came across so much stuff.
Absolutely.
That you actually created another mini documentary, a half-hour show, The All-Stars of the Nonpartisan League. We've been sharing some excerpts of the All-Stars. You just mentioned A.C. Townley. That's one that we've already shared. Lynn Frazier's section we shared, the former U.S. Senator and Governor of North Dakota. You mentioned Bill Langer, Wild Bill Langer. Very well known in North Dakota history.
Yes, even now. He's still people's idea of what the Nonpartisan League is.
Well, in the 1930s, as you mentioned, he was trying to bring the league back, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we've got an excerpt from the show All Stars of the Nonpartisan League, which will premiere Monday, September 17th, a week from the premiere of the actual 3-hour documentary. And this one will air on the 17th at 9:30 p.m. Central. But let's get a sample of the All-Stars of the Nonpartisan League. This is the story of Bill Langer, as told by Richard Stenberg, Associate Professor of History at Williston State College, and Charles Barber, Professor Emeritus of History at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago.
Bill Langer becomes a hero so many people because of his very unorthodox and extreme ways of doing things and getting himself elected.
He really has an important historical reference, aside from his personality, which is what people remember and should, because he really was Wild Bill Langer in many ways, but not the way people would think.
Can be certain, as long as I'm in the Senate, I will be in there battling for North Dakota and for the United States of America.
He was not crooked. I've had lots of experiences in Chicago politics to attest to what that is. And he was not a womanizer. He loved his wife, Lydia, and she knew it. He was wild only in his style of fighting for the underdog.
Bill Langer had his own way of connecting with the people. He'd get up in the back of a box of a grain truck parked down on Main Street and deliver a great stem-winding speech. And if you ever see footage of Bill Langer, you can put some signal flags in his arms and he looks like he's doing a semaphore, you know, that great big, rousing type, fisticuffs and so on. That's how they spoke, the great stump speakers of that era. He had a very folksy way wherever you would travel in the state. He was well known. Hey, if you're ever in Bismarck, stop by the governor's mansion. Lydia will pour you a cup of coffee. But he had a way to really connect with people. And the fact that he could slip into German was very powerful and motivating to a number of the Germans in the state as well. Very, very mobilizing to get them involved in politics.
His grandfather had emigrated from what today would be Moravia, and so therefore he's an ethnic German by definition. He read German and he spoke in that language so that in working the political hustings, he could work it in the German language and be fully understood and appreciated. If you're speaking in the German language at that time to an audience, some of whom speak only German, you're going to get credit even if you're boring. Well, he's from Castleton. His father was a farmer and a banker. They knew they were being cheated by the big banks. It was the Wall Street, the railroads, and the grain merchants. And he did something about it. I think his skill was as a trial lawyer. He had a short career at UND because he finished the degree. It was a 2-year degree for a law degree. He went east. That's where the enemy grew up, the Wall Street people. Bill Langer went to Columbia, New York City, for 4 years there and finished his degree. And that's where he met his wife, Lydia. Her father was one of the architects of the Metropolitan Opera House of New York. And so they were high society, and Bill Langer was this German Catholic boy from North Dakota. She was the niece of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She had a kind of social conscience that a niece of Elizabeth Cady Stanton would be expected to have. That was part of his attraction to her. However, her family was horrified, especially her mother, who would not let him enter the house. And his parents were appalled, too, because she was Protestant, she was Presbyterian, and they were Catholic, and he was proposing to marry out of the church. From the time they met in 1910 till the time they married was 8 years, 1918. And I like to say that Bill Langer never waited for anybody else in his life, except he waited for Lydia. They are corresponding in this period. She is observing the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, while she is witnessing some of the horrors of, basically, we would call it slave labor today. He is jumping into the formation of the Nonpartisan League. I don't think Bill Langer is really a typical North Dakotan. He's in your face. He fought for these really, really noble issues. If the issue mattered and if it was economic justice, if he was a minority one, and sometimes he was, he didn't care.
The voters of North Dakota kind of collectively had the attitude, Bill Langer is a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
But you know from that day to this, during all these years, the farmers raising durum have been getting that premium.
One of my first years of teaching, I had the privilege of having one of my oldest students I ever had. I had an 88-year-old woman from here in Williston that attended my class, and my North Dakota history class, and she knew full well. I remember Bill Langer, and she would tell the story, and it was wonderful to see the kids in the class hearing this woman talk about Bill Langer.
Looking at his life work, the fact is some politicians start out as fighting for the underdog but become less interested. Well, he continued this and he added lists of underdogs, which by the time he was finished included blacks, Jews, Palestinians, as well as his fellow Germans, which include people of the German language from all over the map that he defended and worked to help from the U.S. Senate. Well, he was committed as a progressive, as a son of North Dakota, as a champion of this movement for economic justice. But he was their guy. I had a wonderful conversation with Jim Aberesk, the former senator from South Dakota, and we talked about Langer. And he said, the thing I loved about Bill Langer is he just didn't give a damn. In other words, he didn't give a damn what people thought if he thought he was doing the right thing.
Scholar is Charles Barber, Professor Emeritus of History at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago, and Richard Stenberg, Associate Professor of History at Williston State College in Williston. An excerpt from the All-Stars of the Nonpartisan League, which will air on Prairie Public's television service Monday, September 17th at 9:30, sort of an offshoot of the great big thing that premieres Monday, September 10th at 7 Central on Prairie Public, Kim Stengen's big final project.
It's my swan song.
The Rise and Fall of the Nonpartisan League. How did you select the scholars for this story?
I did a lot of research. I've been reading books and articles and doctoral theses and master degree papers and simply started reaching out to people that I really thought had some great dependable information. There's a lot of great stories about Bill Langer and about Lynn Frazier, but you know, personal anecdotes are always a little bit suspect. So I went right to the source with historians who had done their due diligence and could speak authoritatively.
You tell the story in three parts?
In three parts, yes.
And what are the parts?
The first one I've titled "Will Stick, Will Win." That's the league's motto. It tells the story of their first really big political success of taking over state government, of getting all of their platform, at least through the process of becoming law. The second one is called Storms on the Horizon. One of these scholars told me, you know, the thing is, politically, you'll find people are ready for a change. And after 2 years, they want to go back to the way it used to be because the change is pretty scary. That happened with the league. They started having some problems. There was a huge fallout between the more conservative elements of the league and Bill Langer and the more progressives. And the party essentially split after they finally got their bank created. They got the state mill created. Their other programs were all ready to go. The voters got cold feet and recalled all of the three key state officials.
Wow.
Yeah. First state in the union to have recalled an elected official. And we were the only one for a long time until California here recently. So that's part two, talks about how things came apart. And then the third part is looking at the Langer years, where the party, you know, hitting the economic depression that was devastating the entire country. Bill Langer saw that there was still a need for something like the Nonpartisan League to stand up for farmers and stand up for North Dakotans and make sure that we made it through this in pretty good shape. So we look then at the years of the 1930s all the way up through the story of how the NPL came to move away from the Republican Party that they had been so closely allied with and over to the Democrats.
Interesting story to tell, no question about it.
Yeah.
And when this movement, this league is getting organized, it's around the time that things are getting pretty exciting in Europe. The First
Yes.
World War is starting to come together. You've got the IWW, the Wobblies, the International Workers of the World, organizing in the U.S., sort of the socialist movement in the workers' movement. And so this is just a stew pot of stuff going on.
It is. It was the interesting time that you hear about. This was just a turmoil with the political situation in Europe, the league beginning to expand. They took a lot of lessons from the socialists. I didn't realize until starting research that Minot actually had a socialist mayor and council for a number of years leading up to World War I. But it was a lot of things all kind of coming to a head with some key personalities that could get things done, and they did. They rewrote North Dakota history, I think.
Well, you mentioned that very interesting little snippet of history about Minot and its socialist leadership from many years ago. Were you surprised by things that you stumbled across as you were working on this?
Oh, constantly. Absolutely constantly. I had known about the Louisiana governor, Huey Long.
Sure. Assassinated.
assassinated. But he was quite the colorful character. Apparently knew Bill Langer and patterned himself after Langer's style of getting himself elected. Surprising things popped up everywhere. The first woman elected to parliament in Canada was a nonpartisan leaguer. The first elected official, of course, leaguers were recalled from office. During World War I, the forerunner of the ACLU had studied the violation of rights that took place in relation to suppressing dissent, suppressing Germans, and found that almost half of the cases nationwide took place in North Dakota. And almost all of those cases were nonpartisan league organizers. That in Minnesota, they used the fear of German war to use as a suppressing tool for political dissent in their state government.
Wow. Well, yeah. What goes around comes around.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Politics is lots of stories told over and over again.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah.
This is, as we've mentioned, your last production for Prairie Public. So let's get a little Kim Stengem history here. How long have you been here?
I've been here in I moved to North Dakota in 1977 because I married a North Dakota boy. And
you came with a good Stengem North Dakota name.
Yes, for sure that. But I worked here at Prairie Public for 23 years in doing television documentaries, which that was not the job I started out in high school, but I can't imagine a better career that I could have had or a better place to have worked.
Well, share some of the titles you've worked on.
Oh, gosh. Well, of course, this one. One of my favorites was homesteading. You know, I grew up with Laura Ingalls Wilder, and that period just fascinated me. And one of my relatives had been a homesteader in Minnesota. I worked on the Bank of North Dakota, which is kind of my first attempt to get the story of the Nonpartisan League told. I did a documentary on prairie churches, which was wonderful to be able to crawl all around the state and just photograph these beautiful, isolated churches in the countryside. One of my favorites, though, was a half hour I did on developing sustainable tourism in Uganda. That was not a country I ever would have imagined I would go to. But now that I've been there, I really am looking forward someday to go back.
Well, all of these documentaries are available to our listeners and viewers online, right?
Absolutely, on our YouTube channel, Prairie Public BeCast. So youtube.com/PrairiePublicBeCast, and they'll be able to see every local production that we have made, as well as the ones that are, once we air them on TV, they go right on the YouTube channel so that people all over the world can watch them.
Well, if they're talking about this 3-hour documentary that will debut Monday, September 10th from 7 to 10 p.m. Central on the television service of Prairie Public, and again, that half-hour All-Stars of the Nonpartisan League, which will air the following Monday at 9:30 Central, a half-hour special about, well, some of the central characters of the Nonpartisan League. So congratulations.
Well, thank you.
A major project, and congratulations on this transition in your life.
It will be an interesting time.
Kim Stengem, the producer of The Rise and Fall of the Nonpartisan League.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura will have a natural North Dakota essay about radon gas. And we'll talk with the NDSU Extension Service's Amy Tickey and Sean Brotherson about the Nurturing Parenting Program. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The two candidates for one of North Dakota's Public Service Commission seats on the November ballot met for a debate on Tuesday. The debate originated from Prairie Public's Fargo studio and was carried statewide on both radio and television. Republican Brian Crotius was appointed to the seat by Governor Doug Burgum, squared off with Democratic candidate Casey Buckman. The winner will finish out the rest of the term when Commissioner Brian Kalk resigned. One of the questions concerned utility rates. Buckman says he would be very wary of any rate increase requests in the wake of the federal tax cuts, which cut the tax rates for utilities from 35% to 21%.
But I thought in 2017, the president and his tax bill gave them a great big tax bill. And I thought they were supposed to put that to the people that they serve. I mean, there's one instance where I'd have to vote no, because they've already got their tax break.
Krasha says the utilities are working on how the tax cut will impact rates. He says while he understands concerns when electric and gas rates go up, especially for low-income people, there are times when higher rates are necessary.
For example, on a current case, we're talking about replacing aging gas line infrastructure, distribution infrastructure. And you have to take that into account because public safety does come into play. So reliable service, safe service is very important, keeping increases to a minimum.
The term ends in 2020. The two candidates for the full six-year term, incumbent Republican Randy Chrisman and Democratic challenger Gene Brandt, will have a debate on Thursday. And the State Public Service Commission has assessed a $1,500 penalty for the Dakota Westmoreland Corporation in connection with an incident in late June near the Beulah Mine.
They had done topsoil stripping too close to a rural cemetery that's out there. The century code prohibits the mine operations within 100 feet of a cemetery, and they were about 85 to 88 feet where they had stripped topsoil.
Commissioner and PSC Chairman Randy Chrisman says Westmoreland was cited $1,000 for negligence and $500 for the seriousness of the violation. He says the corporation did respond accordingly in remedying the situation.
The immediate remedial action was respreading topsoil and seeding it to within that 100-foot buffer zone and then marking the buffer zone, and they did that immediately.
Chrisman says Westmoreland had only one other violation in the past 3 years, and there were no additional penalties being imposed for history of violations. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Natural North Dakota is the title of a series of essays authored by Chuck Lura. Chuck teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and he voices his essays about the natural world we live in. Today, his topic is about something we may not realize we live with, radon gas.
What's radon? That question came up in a conversation recently. I suspect that the majority of North Dakotans have heard something about radon in our soils and that it's associated with lung cancer. It's definitely here, but I rarely hear mention of radon in conversation. Radon is an element. It's a colorless, odorless, and tasteless radioactive gas. It's on the periodic table of elements over on the far right column. Its symbol is Rn, and it has an atomic number of 86, but it's the radioactive aspect of radon that's of concern. Radioactive substances are unstable, and as a result give off radiation. Radon is one of several breakdown products in the decay of uranium. Uranium may be found in bedrock, water, or soil, but remember that radon is a gas, so may also be found in the air. It might surprise you, but exposure to radon ranks second only to smoking as a cause of lung cancer. Radon's not much of a risk in the outdoors because it's so diluted in the atmosphere. But in buildings close to the ground, such as basements, first floors, and crawl spaces, particularly with poor ventilation, radon may move up from the ground and through the porous materials, cracks in the foundation, sump holes, and the like, to become concentrated in the space above. Here in the United States, it's been estimated that 1 in 15 homes have elevated levels of radon. A quick look at the Environmental Protection Agency's map of radon risk levels shows that all of North Dakota and a good portion of our region lies in what the EPA calls Zone 1, the zone of highest risk. Furthermore, according to the North Dakota Department of Health's radon fact sheet, 63% of North Dakota homes test above the action level, the level at which corrective action is recommended. Testing kits for radon are widely available and affordable. As I understand it, if an area tests high for radon, corrective action such as sealing floors and foundations and/or installing better ventilation can often markedly reduce the risk factors. For your information, I've put a link to the North Dakota Department of Health's webpage on radon, along with a text of this natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau, You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Sean Brotherson. He's an NDSU Extension Family Life Specialist, and we've had him on our show before. Sean, welcome back.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate the invitation.
And on the phone from Valley City is Amy Tickey. She is the Extension Program Coordinator for the Nurturing Parenting Program. Thank you for joining us, Amy.
Thanks so much, Doug. Again, happy to be here.
And what is the Nurturing Parenting Program, Amy?
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of information about that, Doug. The Nurturing Parenting Program is a 16-week evidence-based and family-focused parent education program. It's free. Okay, we provide dinner, we provide child care, we obviously have adult programming, we also have children's programming that goes in tandem with the adult programming. We can help out with transportation, and so we make every effort to make sure that we can reduce the barriers for families that are wanting to participate. The program is sponsored by the North Dakota Department of Human Services, Children and Family Services Division, and is delivered through a partnership with NDSU Extension. That's where Sean and I come in. And it's offered in 10 communities in North Dakota. The program itself was developed by Dr. Stephen Babalik, who's really known as a leader in child abuse and neglect prevention. And this program has been taught, nationally and internationally. And it's been in use in North Dakota, since before I was around, so the 1990s. So I think it's been in the state for, a good long time. The overall goal of nurturing parenting is to give parents the tools and support they need to create a nurturing environment for their children. And, that's really our goal. We know that children do best in a nurturing environment, and that's the goal of the program. To say a little bit about, who the program is for, the program is valuable for any family, and it's open to any family in North Dakota. I don't know of any parent on the planet that would say that they've got this parenting thing under control, right?
Well, Sean, what is your role with the program?
Yeah, as Amy mentioned, the program is operated under the support of the North Dakota Department of Human Services. And about a decade ago, they came to us and as NDSU Extension. Our mission with NDSU Extension is to provide lifelong learning opportunities for citizens in the state of North Dakota in a variety of areas, but that includes strengthening individual well-being and family life. So my specific role is to support those kinds of programs, so we were very willing to adopt this partnership with the Department of Human Services. And so one of the things that we really wanted to do was to have a better understanding of who we serve in this program and are we effective in serving them? Are we making a difference in their lives and in their family experience? So specifically, my job is to make sure that that we continue to provide content that is research-based, current in the field as far as family strengthening efforts, and then specifically to evaluate this program every year and to provide feedback to the Department of Human Services, both on who we are serving and then are we serving them effectively. So finding out some results from the program through survey research procedures and things like that.
Amy, it's 16 weeks. That's 4 months. It's free. You've got some meals provided, stuff for the kids to do as the parents are talking about the nurturing parenting program. Are the places jammed? I mean, do you have to turn people away?
It depends on the site. We have some rural sites and some more urban sites, and it depends on the given session. There are times when we do have waiting lists for the program, and other times we're actively recruiting. So it just depends.
And why is this important, Sean?
Well, first of all, because you might think about what's the public value of doing something like this. Why do we do parent education? And parent education has a number of benefits. It not only strengthens families, but if you look downstream, children who are raised in healthy, nurturing settings tend to do better. They're less likely to fall into crime difficulties, for example. So it lowers costs for crime. They typically do better in school, so they don't need so much in terms of remedial education. So it lowers costs that we spend on education for kids who may not be doing well. So in a variety of ways, it actually reduces costs that we may incur if kids are not doing well. And it also provides that really positive nurturing experience that we want children to have. The other thing is, you think about it, I have a daughter right now who's turned 15, and she's really excited because she can get trained to get her driver's license.
Yeah.
When you make that transition to being a parent or a caregiver of a child, we don't screen you and give you a parenting license. But a program like this offers us the opportunity to provide the training and the knowledge and the skills that help you to be an effective parent or caregiver. And we think that's really important. And I guess, the last thing with this program is, as Amy noted, it's for any individual who's providing care for a child. And there are versions of the program that are targeted towards raising younger children, like, say, ages 0 to 5, raising a little bit older children, like school age 5 to 12. So you can kind of pick an option that might work for you. But we want to create healthy, nurturing relationships in families before problems arise. So it's a prevention approach. But this program is also helpful to families who may have higher levels of stress, who may be having some difficulties with their functioning. And so in that sense, it specifically also assists with preventing potential difficulties with child abuse or child neglect.
So, Amy, are some of these people kind of referred to you?
Right. We do have some families that are, like I said, it's open to any family in North Dakota. So we do have families that will call and say, hey, we're really interested in strengthening our family. We hear that we have this opportunity available in our community and we'd like to take part. So we do have a number of self-referred families. We do have others that are referred by agencies that they're working with, including social services. And then we have those that are maybe have some involvement with the child welfare system, and they're mandated to go by the court system. So we'll have a mix.
Well, when I look at something called the Nurturing Parenting Program, the first thing I think about is, young kids, very young kids, like terrible twos. But Sean mentions his 15-year-old daughter. And, of course, there are other periods of transition that can be pretty trying in the family. So is this for any age group, any mix of family?
Right. It is. We're actually using a curriculum right now that's geared for children up through adolescence. And, oftentimes we will have families that will attend that have, a number of children, and they could be in different age ranges. So you might have an infant, you have a toddler, and you have a 10th grader. So oftentimes a family will come with a mix of ages just within their own unit.
Who leads the sessions? Who facilitates?
Good question. We have facilitators at each site, and this program is really is built to be staff heavy. In other words, it's an intensive program. So we have two adult facilitators for each age group. We have two children's facilitators that work with the children in their different age categories. We have one for 5 to 8 and another for 9 to 12, if the numbers warrant it. And we also have a site coordinator that's on site each evening.
Well, Sean, you mentioned this has been around for about a decade or so, and I suspect that the curriculum sort of changes because you do use research-based, evidence-based stuff. So you're always looking for new material?
Yeah, we're always aware of new research in the field that we think is helpful for parents to understand. For example, in recent years, there's been a lot of research on the effect of trauma on young children, and actually that it has a lot of negative effects down the road for their physical health and well-being as adults. We see like elevated levels of everything from heart disease to cancer when kids go through really traumatic experiences in childhood. So sometimes there's research like that opens a window into why a nurturing environment is really important for children that we may not have known or seen the connection before. So we'll do updates to the curriculum and then go through training with all of our staff to be able to provide that understanding to them so that they can incorporate it as they teach and interact with families who are in the program. And then one of the specific things we want to do is find out, again, how is the program working. So there's a evaluation that we use every year. We evaluate things like how are the parents with regard to their empathy towards children and their needs. Like when a children, you know, when a child is crying, is the parent sensitive to, I need to intervene, and how do I need to intervene? Not in a harsh way, but in a supportive way. And we assess parents prior to coming into the program, and then we assess them at the end of the program. And it's my role to do that assessment and to see, is there any difference? And
do you share it with those parents then?
Typically what we do is we write a state report, and then there's embedded within that is a report for each site. Mm-hmm. And so the local facilitators will have an idea of what has happened, and they can share with parents like, okay, where they're seeing some growth, maybe where there's some opportunity to still do some learning. But one of the really great things about the partnership that we've had with NDSU as a research-based institution is it allows us to provide feedback not just to the Department of Human Services but to the public about, hey, are your taxpayer dollars working here? And we have about 250 to 300 families that go through the program every year. One of the really positive things is that we've seen significant gains for people who go through this program. They become more empathetic and nurturing. They become significantly less likely to use harsh punishment. They find alternatives and ways to guide their children that are less harsh, more positive and nurturing. So those are real positive things that we see coming as a result of this program and the research that we do on it.
The Nurturing Parenting Program is a project of the Department of Human Services, Children and Family Services, and NDSU's Extension Services in partnership with the Parent Education Network. That's a mouthful, Amy. but it also is sort of a pitch because you've got registration coming up, don't you, for the fall session? You've got another one in January, but what do people need to know to register for fall?
Right. You know, well, we're actually already underway. We had a number of programs that started last night, so we have a number that are starting this week. We have a couple that are starting the first part of October, and then we do have sites that either hold a spring-only session starting in January. I think that's a little bit of a misnomer when you say spring and January, but, you know.
Optimistic, yeah.
Right. So we have some that are run only in the spring. We have others that run twice a year, and we have those that run only in the fall. And that information is available on our website. It's ndwww.ndnurturing.org or O-R-G. And under programs and locations, we have brochures for each site that gives all the details in terms of registration for that particular location.
And the fall sessions are Belcourt, Bismarck, Devil's Lake, Dickinson, Fargo, Jamestown, Minot, Valley City, and Williston. So coming to a city near you or in your city, the January sessions are in Belcourt, Bismarck, Fargo, Harvey, and Minot. Again, that website, ndnurturing.org. Sean, there's a science here we're talking, family science. We've talked about this before, but we are learning about how families, how the family dynamic works, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and in addition to the yearly research that we have done on this program, we are, you know, always asking questions about what more can we learn. So, for example, I mentioned, you know, what's the experience of trauma, and so there are new measures that look that we could, you know, at some point we're just exploring research ideas at NDSU of how we might be able to help understand the experience of individuals in this program and help them more. So, you know, one thing that we may do is say, okay, provide the adults with an assessment as part of their learning experience that did you experience anything in your childhood that was traumatic? And if they have, then we can help them to understand maybe how that affects how they experience stress as an adult and how it affects them in responding to their children. And so we're always looking for ways to bring existing opportunities for research and then strengthen this program and really to benefit the individuals who are involved in the program. For example, if we find that, well, maybe we have some parents who are coming, like here in the Fargo-Moorhead area, say, for example, we have a lot of people who have come to the community that are new Americans. Is the program working for that population if they're involved in the program? So we might look and say, okay, does if we have somebody of that background in the program, is it working for them as effectively as it working for other participants in the program? So we're always trying to learn and ask questions that will help us to keep it a quality program and make improvements to it as well.
Amy, it's a 16-week program. Is it once a week? How long do the sessions last? And could you just give us a sense of what would happen in a typical session?
Right. So it is 16 weeks. It is once a night. We usually start 5:30. We start with dinner. After dinner, we have a family activity time, which, to be honest, is one of my favorite times of the evening, where we do arts and crafts, or we do a musical activity, or we have a special guest come in, that type of thing, where the family is really getting together and enjoying something as a family unit. Then we separate out. We have our children either in a child care setting, or we have them in children's programming, and the adults go on to the adult class. And again, that lasts once a week for 16 weeks.
And is there a curriculum that people sort of tick off things as they go along here?
Right. We do have a curriculum. And, some of the topics would include things like, we start out asking about the family and the family. What's your story? Tell us a little bit. So we're really spurring some reflection. We talk about nurturing, the philosophy of nurturing. What does that look like as a lifestyle? Sean mentioned empathy. That's one area where we see a lot of growth over the course of the program. But we'll start out by defining it and talking about it, giving some examples and holding some activities doing some activities that really illustrate, what empathy is and are building empathy. So, yeah.
Well, Sean, how do you measure empathy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. This particular program, there are corresponding measures that have been developed that have gone through rigorous testing to make sure that they're good psychological evaluations or behavioral evaluations of a parent's attitudes or behaviors. And so we try to pick things that have already been validated by previous research on maybe a specific outcome that we're interested in. So we might be interested, like I said, in what is a parent's attitude toward discipline and punishment of children, and what kind of strategies they're going to use, or what is their understanding of child development and how to respond to specific needs. So we use existing measures that have been validated by science, and then we give them at different points in time and then measure the differences between those that people experience.
Sean Brotherson is an NDSU Extension Family Life Specialist. Amy Tickey is the Extension Program Coordinator for the Nurturing Parenting Program. Again, more information at ndnurturing.org. Sean, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Doug, and we appreciate the opportunity.
And Amy, thanks for joining us from Valley City.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, Decoded 8 Book.
So, who should you ask for a reliable recommendation on where to eat out when you travel?
Well, for one thing, never ask a concierge in a hotel, never ask a taxi driver.
What's the best thing about taking a trip to China?
And the big thing I came back with was a sense of the warmth of the Chinese people.
And when in Rome?
A visit to Rome without the Pantheon just cannot happen.
It's all on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative producing reliable electricity for 141-member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Decoded 8 Book for September 5th. North Dakota remembers World War I. Among the North Dakota soldiers fighting somewhere in France were a number of young men of Jewish faith. Sam Rigler from Taylor, North Dakota, trusted in his faith to survive life in the trenches. He was quoted in the newspaper as saying, "There I was, huddled up against the side of a trench. I silently offered prayers to God and asked for divine guidance and protection." In a letter to his brother, he stated, "The word was passed around that we were going over the top at 5 a.m. Just before daybreak, we climbed over, packs thrown away, but rifles loaded and bayonets fixed. The battle was raging, shells cracking, hissing, and exploding but a few feet away. We crept along close to the ground. Dawn was setting in, and the explosion of the shells lighted up the sky. There we were, out there in no man's land, and only the will of God could save us." He noted that food was difficult to obtain at the front, and after having meals of raw potatoes, a cooked dinner was a precious commodity. On one occasion, a German shell exploded a short distance away, knocking the food and coffee from his hands. He flattened out close to the ground, while the dirt and rock showered down on him. but he never lost sight of his bread, bacon, and potatoes. When the barrage lifted, the food was hurriedly gathered into his empty coffee cup and quickly devoured in a nearby trench. Sam Riegler entered the trenches on the Jewish holiday of Rosh Hashanah, and on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish year, he was lying in the hospital, having been slightly gassed. Meanwhile, back in North Dakota, the service flag of the Fargo Synagogue displayed 30 stars representing Jewish soldiers from the community serving at the front. The Reverend J. Klitzner prayed for those Jewish boys in the trenches who were unable to perform their New Year's obligations. He announced that they were now fighting for a greater ideal, the restoration of the Jews to the land of their fathers. For it was on this date in 1918 that local newspapers revealed that Great Britain, France, and Italy had declared that Palestine, once liberated, would be used to create a Jewish homeland. Chapters of the Zionist Organization of America were formed in Grand Forks, Fargo, and other cities to assist with the Palestine movement. Harry Lashkowitz of Fargo believed that it was the ardent desire for every Jew to fight to the utmost and make this a safe world for them to live in. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hi, I'm Matt O'Lean. Join my colleague, Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, Thursday, September 6th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, on TV, radio, and online for a half-hour debate in the race for North Dakota Public Service Commission with the candidates Democrat Gene Brandt and Republican Randy Christman. That's Thursday, September 6th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, on Prairie Public's TV, radio, and online streams and apps. I hope you'll join us.
Prairie Public 2018 debates are made possible in part by AARP North Dakota.
Nature is filled with predators.
They can use what's referred to as a wolf pack.
And creepy things.
There's also organisms that act almost like a vampire.
But these shouldn't scare you. Scientists have discovered germ-eating bacteria that can treat infections and protect us from disease. Plus, the latest on Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, Leo Kuntz, the founder of the Nokota Horse Conservancy, passed away unexpectedly last month. Leo's family met to discuss the future of the conservancy, and joining Ashley Thornburg on Thursday with an update on our show will be one of Leo's sisters. Also on Thursday, foraging is this week's food topic with Sue Balcom of the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan. And Ashley and Eric Dethridge will have the What's Happening calendar of things to do on the weekend. I'll be taking some time off. I'll be back, later in September. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.